F going on in 2020, we are running out of Dr. Pepper. We'll have that story at the end of the hour. First, looking at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 3,670. Ector County negative, 16,689 out of 20,595 tested, with 236 pending, 57 deaths. Recovered, 2,880. Active, 733. Midland County, 2,676 confirmed out of 13,362 tested and 49 deaths. Texas Tribune today says that Texas reports 324 more people died from coronavirus, a new single-day record. 7,028 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 12th. That's 1,427 less than a week ago, and they occupy 12.9% of hospital beds. 6,200 new cases were reported on August 12th. There were 18,337 viral tests reported on August 11th. That made the positivity rate 23%. 9,034 Texans have died as of August 12th, 324 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,537 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $42.35, which is down 32 cents. And let's stay on the economy for just a moment with more numbers. Nearly 3.2 million Texans have filed for unemployment relief since mid-March. That's as of August 8th. Texas's unemployment rate was 8.6% in June, up from 3.4% from June 2019. In July, Texas's sales tax revenues were up 4.3% from July 2019. Now here are coronavirus briefs. The United States logged nearly 1,500 coronavirus-related fatalities on Wednesday, making that the deadliest day of the summer so far. The grim tally is the highest since mid-May, signaling that America does not have the pandemic under control despite stabilizing case numbers. Despite the soaring death count, President Trump continued to press for the nation's schools to bring children into classrooms, for businesses to open, and for athletes to fill stadiums. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has updated its guidance on face masks, warning that those with valves or vents do not prevent the wearer from spreading COVID-19 to others. The president also said the U.S. Postal Service does not have enough money to facilitate mail-in voting for the November election, and he has no intention of approving emergency funds. The World Health Organization and American Dental Association are at odds over whether routine dental care should be delayed during the pandemic. Now, here are a few longer stories. Back to unemployment. On the national level, another 963,000 Americans filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week on a seasonally adjusted basis, the Department of Labor said today. This was the lowest number of weekly initial claims since the pandemic shut down the U.S. economy. It is the first time in 5 months that fewer than 1 million have filed for first-time jobless benefits. Economists say it's encouraging that claims for unemployment are going down because it means people are returning to work. That said, the persistently high claims numbers also tell us this recovery won't be an easy or quick feat. Continued jobless claims, which count people who have filed for unemployment benefits for at least 2 weeks in a row, stood at 15.5 million. A new attempt to restart economic relief negotiations between the White House and Democrats ended just minutes after it began Wednesday, with President Trump appearing to cast doubt on the whole process by announcing a deal is not going to happen. U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's director, Dr. Robert Redfield, said that non-coronavirus public health initiatives have been sidetracked during the pandemic in an interview with WebMD Chief Medical Officer John White on Wednesday. Redfield said the collateral damage of the pandemic is evident in that public health officials have been forced to turn their focus away from issues such as preventing maternal mortality, addressing AIDS, treating people for hepatitis C, and preventing tobacco use in children. Coronavirus continues to spread at high rates across the South, Midwest, and West, even as the total number of new cases has declined following a summer surge. Nationally, over the past 7 days, the United States is averaging about 53,000 new cases per day, down 11% from the week prior. As educators and parents clash over starting in-person classes, some schools that have reopened have seen new cases. More than 2,000 students, teachers, and staff have been placed under quarantine in the few reopened districts in several states, a CNN tally of reported cases show. Of those, at least 230 positive coronavirus cases have been reported among the school districts reopened for in-person learning. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has called on all Americans to pull together for your country to help stop the spread of COVID-19, saying the U.S. was in a war against the disease. "I'm asking you to do four simple things: wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands, and be smart about crowds," CDC Director Robert Redfield said Wednesday in an interview with WebMD. "I'm not asking some of America to do it. We all got to do it." Redfield reiterated his warning that if Americans do not adhere to these recommendations, this could be the worst fall season from a public health perspective we've ever had. The CDC director urged Americans to prepare for a difficult fall season by getting the flu vaccine. In a letter, public health advisors to the U.S. government said they are extremely concerned and troubled about the change in how hospitals report COVID-19 data. Nearly three dozen current and former members of the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee shared their concerns in a letter intended to be read by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and obtained by CNN. The committee is an independent group of experts that provide guidance to the HHS and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on infection control practices and strategies. When asked by CNN, HHS did not confirm if it had received the letter. Members of the committee said that the CDC, which is part of HHS, was informed of the letter. The letter, dated July 31st, described hospitals as scrambling to determine how to meet new daily COVID-19 reporting requirements to HHS. In a memo posted on the HHS website on July 10th, the Trump administration ordered all hospitals to report all COVID-19 patient information to HHS rather than to the CDC and HHS, as they had been doing. The Trump administration said the change would streamline the data collection process. "We are extremely concerned about this abrupt change in COVID-19 reporting," the letter said. "Retiring the CDC system that was in operation would have serious consequences on data integrity. By removing the data collection task from the CDC, the country would lose decades of expertise in interpreting and analyzing information about infectious disease, and it would jeopardize the department's goals of developing interventions that would improve public health," the letter said. In a statement to CNN, an HHS official said the CDC system was unable to keep up with the demands of the pandemic. "Today, CDC has access to all the data it once had and more. The CDC's NHSN was unable to keep up with the fast-paced data collection demands of the COVID-19 pandemic," Michael Caputo, HHS Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs, said in an email. Now from the Associated Press, Texas surpasses 9,000 virus deaths as testing remains low. Texas surpassed 9,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths Wednesday, while testing again dropped to the lowest levels since June, and infection rates hit another record. The state on Wednesday reported 324 additional deaths, bringing the total number of confirmed new deaths added from COVID-19 over the past week alone to more than 1,600. Some of those deaths occurred in July, when Texas began waiting on death certificates before adding to the total number of fatalities. Officials in regions hard hit this summer by the virus, including Houston and the Rio Grande Valley, say trends are improving after weeks of overcrowded hospitals and alarming rises in new confirmed cases. Testing demand has also lowered. Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins said Tuesday that the number of individuals showing up for tests has dropped by 40%, which reflects trends nationwide. Republican Governor Greg Abbott has said surge testing in hotspots earlier this summer has also seen a decline, falling Tuesday below a rolling 7-day average of 29,000 for the first time since June. The fewer tests have led to the 7-day positivity rate climbing to more than 24%. The Texas Department of State Health Services did not respond Wednesday to questions about the decrease in testing numbers. Now we'll move to our recorded reports. This first from NPR is about Texas and California health officials saying that a major hurdle for contact tracers is mistrust.
We've known for months that contact tracing is a key part of getting the coronavirus under control. Contact tracing is a two-step process. First, investigating people who've tested positive to find out who they've been around, and then calling all their contacts to make sure they can safely isolate. CDC Director Robert Redfield stressed how important that process is back in April.
The major thrust of how we're going to control and make sure that we continue to keep this nation open is early case recognition, isolation, and contact tracing. That's the fundamentals of public health. That's what we're going to do.
Well, now, as the virus has infected more than 5 million Americans, the U.S. only has about 41,000 contact tracers, not even half what public health experts said would be needed to help contain the spread of the virus. Those who are on the job are running into some big challenges, and we've invited two local health officials to talk about those challenges with us. Aaliyah Franciscus of Harris County Public Health in Houston, Texas, and Michael Osher of the Riverside County Department of Public Health in the Los Angeles area. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
Thank you, Ari.
Both of your states had a steep increase in COVID-19 cases from June into July. The numbers are now going down a bit. How does the number of contact tracers that you have where you are compare to the number you need?
So I can fill this one first. We hired the correct number that we anticipated needing at the beginning of the incline. We did not anticipate it climbing so quickly and so steeply. And then we were not able to get as many as we needed to kind of overcome that hurdle.
So that's the outlook in Houston. What about in Southern California?
In Riverside, California, in the county, we had 120 through May, and then when the numbers went increased, we did a whole big influx of new hiring of temporary workers, and we've now in the 7 weeks hired 360 contact tracers. The issue is case investigators, because there's so many cases we need to interview first so the contact tracers can call people.
And I'll echo that. That's an issue that we're having as well, because there's a different level of skill sets that's needed to be an investigator. You're that initial point of contact for these confirmed cases, and there's just not enough. So then you bottleneck before you can get to even the contact tracing piece.
For contact tracing to work, people need quick test results. It doesn't do much good to get in touch with close contacts if it takes a week or more for people to find out they have the disease. We should note that California's public health director has just resigned as the state works through a huge backlog of unprocessed tests. Are test results where you are coming in fast enough for contact tracing to work?
So that was a huge issue for us in Harris County for a long time. And we were using commercial labs, but everyone is using commercial labs. So they were quickly becoming overwhelmed. And it was taking up to 3 weeks for us to get a result, which,
three
as you
weeks.
Know, 3 weeks. So by the time we were calling people, not only was it no longer helpful in terms of public health infection control, they were upset with us for it taking so long and even less likely to cooperate.
Of course.
So we actually now we've partnered with a local research university, and they're giving us a turnaround time of 48 hours for our test results.
Michael, what are things like in Riverside County?
Yes. So originally we had 2 to 3 day turnaround with the commercial labs. That expanded to 7 to 9 days. It's now 5 to 7 for the negatives, but we are seeing 2 to 3 days on the positives, but there's still another day delay while it goes through the state system. And so I would say we're reaching people about day 7, which for contacts, they may not be so bad. But yes, when it was 9 days, it was not helpful at all.
Yeah. Let's talk about the issue of trust. When you call people and say, tell me everybody you've had close contact with in the last few days, are they willing to share that information?
They're willing to tell us about their family contacts, who lives in the house, but they're not willing to share their friends, who they saw, the stores they went to. And that's been a huge problem because much of our spread has been through those informal barbecues, get-togethers, and other places that these people have been that we are having a hard time tracking down.
Yeah, it's the same thing in Harris County. We actually had to, and we created a software system because our regular system could not handle the number of COVID-19 cases that we were getting. And we actually had to add a button that said unwilling to share contacts or unknown batch of contacts. Like, wow. They'll say, oh, I went to a party and there were 30 people, but I'm not going to give you their names. When we try and get into the nitty gritty, like, you know, oh, you went to a bar. What bar did you go to? They won't tell us because then they're afraid we're going to shut that bar down.
Do you run into that sort of thing, like with 1 in 10 calls, half the calls? I mean, can you quantify it?
I would say for Harris County is upwards of 50%. I would say half are very cooperative.
Wow.
Another 25% are semi-cooperative, and the other 25 are absolutely unwilling to share anything. There's so much misinformation being put out right now. So our contact tracers are being, they're being called names. They're being cursed at. Derogatory language is being used because there's been these seeds of mistrust thrown into the community. So when we call, nothing we say can establish that trust where they'll be willing to share information with us. They think that the numbers are inflated. We've heard multiple people say that we're getting paid to make up results. So it's so difficult to combat all of this information, this mistrust that's being put out there.
Wow.
So we're finding, looking at businesses, most of the businesses will be very cooperative, but some of the businesses that hire the food processors or the farm workers, they are completely uncooperative and have told their staff who are positive, if they cooperate with us, they'll be terminated. So we have two or three businesses that have had major outbreaks that we can't get into them at all. And that's been a huge problem.
Do you think there's anything you can do to build more trust and make contact tracing more effective and make people more responsive?
We are hiring appropriate people to do the contact tracing, both race, ethnicity, language. And we've not done a great job of saying, hey, our contact tracers come from the community. The 360 new tracers we've hired were people that didn't have jobs before. They're part of our community. And I think we've not done a good job saying that the tracers are you. They can help you be healthy and be safe. And we've not done a great job of getting that message out.
You know, back in the spring when everyone was talking about how important contact tracing would be to solving this problem, did either of you expect that it would be this tough?
We always said that this was the first wave and the first wave never ended. And when mid-May came along with Mother's Day, Memorial Day, Father's Day, we tried to get the word out that this has not gone away, that we still needed to wear masks and keep distancing. But things opened up, people didn't listen, and now we've lost all control that was possible in April and early May. Now we have to put that genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, similar to Harris County, I mean, we do use contact tracing, but it's one tool among many that public health workers utilize. So when so much onus was being placed on the importance of contact tracing, we did agree, but we knew that it was going to have to be a multifaceted approach. It was going to have to be used in conjunction with, you know, shutting down businesses, shutting down restaurants, social distancing, mask wearing. So whenever those measures only lasted a month, and they expected contact tracing to basically fill in all those gaps, that was never going to be successful.
That's Aaliyah Franciscus, an epidemiologist with Harris County Public Health in Houston, Texas, and Michael Osier, assistant director and chief health strategist at the Riverside County Department of Public Health in California. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Ari.
Thank you, Ari.
Now we're going to bring you three reports related to schools. The first report is from the Texas Standard today. Schools in session, but Texas does not yet have a plan for tracking COVID-19 in the classroom. And then, also from the Texas Standard, how special education professionals keep teaching during COVID-19. And then, from NPR, Georgia parents rethink kids going to school after a year's rough start.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Some Texas schools are back to in-person classes, and as more prepare to reopen, questions remain over whether state leaders will report or even explicitly collect data on COVID-19 cases in its public schools. Corbett Smith writes, doing so would give a glimpse on how safely Texas and its school systems are managing the return to campus. Smith is an education reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He joins us now. Corbett, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What have Texas and the Texas Education Agency said about tracking COVID-19 in schools?
Well, at this point, and we are at least a week into some schools around the state actually having classes, mm-hmm. they're still considering the option. When I reached out to them almost 2 weeks ago, they at first didn't have a response, and a week later said, well, we're investigating that. Check with the Texas Department of State Health Services to see whether or not they're tracking it. I reached out to that department, and they themselves also said that they were considering the options, but no one definitively has decided to take up that at this point. And you know, you're starting to see in the Metroplex, we've had several school districts open for in-person instruction. You've got places all across the state doing so here in the next couple of weeks. So as we are entering this really uncertain time for schools and in the COVID-19 pandemic, you've got a lot of questions as to whether or not people will get a full and accurate measure as to whether we're doing it safely.
Well, not only has school begun, but there's already been cases linked to teachers, to students. Is that right?
That's correct. In the Metroplex, there's been several cases, but these cases have been semi-related to school functions, be it cheerleading camps or teacher in-service days. So we haven't seen at this point in the Dallas-Fort Worth area any cases of something in the fall semester. I reported last week of an incident in Plano ISD where a summer school session for students with disabilities was that they sent out letters to parents informing them that their child might have been infected and might have had contact with somebody who had COVID-19, a positive lab-confirmed case. So I don't think it's a matter of if, it's going to happen. It's just going to be up to, at this point, either county leaders or district officials to figure out how to share that data.
So you report there's already a process for schools to report highly infectious disease cases. How's that working?
Well, I mean, the State Department of Health Services requires that any type of, infectious case, and then, that could, involve any number of different types of illnesses, mm-hmm. that they're required to notify the state when these kind of conditions come through. But it's not up to the state to then, collect those reports and then produce, any type of report. They have not committed to that, nor have they committed to disaggregating that data and telling people how many, cases are in a given county or in a given school district involving schools.
So I guess there's at least two levels of questioning of how this might get processed and who's going to take charge in making that change in the process. So as you said, this data is out there, but I guess the first question is, how it's flagged for local health authorities and then how that flagging continues up to the state, and then who's going to be responsible for the aggregating and the breakdown. And that's, am I right that that's where the questions just remain?
Yeah, in both of those instances. And, local school districts are also kind of being put on the spot right now because they typically don't like to share specific data information. They don't like to say we've had X number of cases at this campus,
right?
Because they normally side with privacy laws, federal privacy laws regarding health and student confidentiality. So they're being asked by parents and by the community, hey, we want to have a better understanding of the number of cases and how things are going in our community.
We've been speaking with Corbett Smith. He's an education reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Corbett, thank you again.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Georgia made the leap to open schools this year. It has been a rough start. Several campuses have already needed to shut down, including one today, and hundreds of students and teachers are in quarantine because of possible exposure. Here is Georgia Public Broadcasting's Ellen Eldridge with more.
Students in Cherokee and Paulding counties in Georgia returned to classes August 3rd, and so did the coronavirus. Still, some parents rallied this week supporting their districts for having in-person instruction.
Give me a C!
Brittany Cooper sent her fifth grader to school, but regrets doing so now. Cooper's daughter has special needs and an individualized educational plan that almost requires in-person instruction. But just a couple of days into school, Cooper changed her mind and asked if her daughter could learn at home instead. The school's principal said the digital classrooms were all full.
We sent her back today. I'm just like, I don't know where to go or what to do. If digital learning's full, it's full, but I don't feel like that's fair.
As the coronavirus has spread in schools, many parents have changed their minds about face-to-face education during a pandemic, especially if pictures have come out showing students walking in crowded hallways. The Fisher family in Woodstock chose to send their seventh grader, Jordan, to school. Jonathan Fisher says at home, his daughter would have missed out on a year of advanced placement classes with help from a teacher and hoped the district would put strict safety protocols in place.
So we decided we were gambling a bit, thinking that the school would do something within the first week or two.
The district did not mandate mask use, though hundreds of teachers begged for it. Parent Brandy Heath's son saw problems on day one. Students were changing classes seven times a day, going to busy gym periods, and eating in crowded cafeterias. As the coronavirus cases came to light, Heath asked to switch to online instruction. The district told her it was too late for that.
So to hear that, we're not going to help you. We don't care how you feel. We're doing everything possible to mandate safety precautions. And if you don't like it, then take your kid and go, is basically what is being told to parents right now.
Ultimately, Heath took complaints to the TV news. After that, her son was able to enroll in digital instruction. As parents in these Georgia districts are learning, the coronavirus is changing safety protocol plans seemingly on a daily basis, leaving students, teachers, and others seeking creative solutions to educating kids this year. For NPR News, I'm Ellen Eldridge in Woodstock, Georgia.
Now we're going to move into school sports. First, at the NCAA level, the chief medical officer of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, NCAA, said, "We're moving into very troubled waters right now," during a Thursday webinar. "When we started talking about a return to sport in April, we were envisioning that there would be a continued downward trajectory of COVID-19 new infections and deaths, that there would be a national surveillance system, national testing, and national contact tracing that would allow us to really navigate this pandemic into re-socializing both in sport and in the rest of society, and that hasn't happened." Dr. Brian Hainline, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer with the NCAA, told the Infectious Diseases Society of America. "And it's made it really challenging to make decisions as we approach fall sport," he said. "We're moving into very troubled waters right now," Hainline said. "It's a very narrow path to get ball sports right." Now, this story from the Texas Tribune today. Big 12 OKs football season, paving way for UT Austin, Texas Tech, TCU, and Baylor to play. The start of the Big 12 Conference's college football season will move forward as scheduled, conference officials said Wednesday, meaning four major Texas football programs are free to play this fall. "Ultimately, our student athletes have indicated their desire to compete in the sports they love this season, and it's up to all of us to deliver a safe, medically sound, and structured academic and athletic environment for accomplishing that outcome," said Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby in a statement. Baylor University, Texas Christian University, Texas Tech University, and the University of Texas at Austin are Big 12 members. The conference president's decision to allow football during the coronavirus pandemic was made official Wednesday morning, a day after the Big Ten and the Pac-12 announced their seasons would be postponed until the spring semester. Bowlesby said member schools have committed to enhanced COVID-19 testing with three tests per week in high-contact sports. Non-conference football opponents must also adhere to testing protocols that match conference standards. All four Texas schools in the Big 12 tweeted in celebration of the decision, posting their slimmed-down schedules in anticipation of the season. The first conference games will kick off September 26th with the conference championship pegged for December 12th. Texas A&M University is part of the Southeastern Conference, which has also signaled its intent to allow teams to play this fall. We will continue to further refine our policies and protocols for a safe return to sports as we monitor developments around COVID-19 in a continued effort to support, educate, and care for our student-athletes every day, said SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey in a statement Tuesday. That leads us into our next report from NPR, how college football is changing as conferences decide whether or not to play.
Could college football teams play any games in the pandemic this fall? The Big Ten and Pac-12 conferences are out. Rutgers President Jonathan Holloway told Morning Edition the decision will have serious repercussions.
So much of your identity is wrapped up in your sport, and the amount of time you spend with your teammates, you spend a tremendous amount of time with your teammates. And so this is going to be destabilizing for thousands of athletes across the country.
Did you hear him say your identity is wrapped up with your sport? Could that be a factor as other major conferences make their decisions? The Big 12, the Atlantic Coast, the Southeastern conferences, they are all still in for the season at the moment. ESPN analyst Paul Feinbaum has covered college football for decades and is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I don't want to overgeneralize, but those conferences that are still in are centered mostly in the South, where football is huge and maybe even a bigger part of people's identity than elsewhere. Is that part of the reason their seasons are still on?
That is correct. In the South, football is a religion, and Saturday is the High Holy Day. And I know that sounds dramatic. It sounds like an exaggeration or hyperbole, but it is not. I've lived every day of my life in the South. And it's indescribable. It's impossible to try to convey in a short period of time how important it is. You don't have weddings in the South on Saturday. You don't have funerals either. You have college football. And quite frankly, rightly or wrongly, it's the only thing that matters.
So if we look at the Southeastern Conference, for example, which is still planning to play so far as we know, does that mean they're really going to play, or that they just have been a little slower to pull the trigger than the Big Ten?
I hope I'm not surprising anyone in your audience that politics has entered into the fray in the conversation of COVID and college football. The Big Ten and the Pac-12 have announced they're not going to play. And the states are clearly more liberal, more progressive in terms of this virus. In the Southeastern Conference, there are 11 states. 10, I believe, have Republican governors. So I know I'm answering part of the question in a rather circuitous manner. But just because they have not pulled the plug yet, Steve, does not mean they are going to play. All they're doing now is planning on and plotting ahead. The season was set to begin Labor Day weekend, and in the SEC, it has now been rescheduled for September 26. So they have time, and they will use it.
I want to grant that some people are in denial about the public health realities of the virus. Let's set that aside for a moment. Let's assume that a lot of college administrators understand that the pandemic is real, that it's serious, that people may die. Do you think that the cultural pull of football is so powerful in some parts of the country that people are just going to say, listen, we understand the risks. We really do understand the risks, but this is worth it. We're going to play.
Yes. I think in terms of the fans, the ones that I deal with every day of the week, that's what I've been hearing since March 12th. They still do not, I don't mean to characterize every one of them, but a large, I would say more than half of the fans I talk to still don't buy it. And I know that a head football coach in this conference described the virus as a cold. So there is a lot of mixed messages, and that's why we are still having this conversation. I still think there's a reasonably good chance nobody will play college football this fall, but at least for the next few weeks, this debate will rage on.
Paul Feinbaum of ESPN, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
He's host of the Paul Feinbaum Show.
Staying with the sports theme for a moment, here's a story that's also related to the NCAA. The NFL would consider rescheduling some games for Saturdays during the upcoming regular season if there is no college football being played this fall, multiple people familiar with the planning of the league and franchise owners said Wednesday. but the league would be unlikely to pursue Saturday games, which could require a waiver of restrictions under its broadcast-related exemption from antitrust laws, if even just a few college football conferences are playing in the fall, according to those people who spoke on the condition of anonymity because the NFL was not divulging its plans publicly amid the tumult to the college season created by the novel coronavirus pandemic. And now to high school sports. A South Texas school district is the first in the state to cancel fall sports.
Imagine Friday nights in Texas with no football this fall. Well, that has become the reality for Ben Bolt Polito Blanco High School in South Texas. The school board there recently voted to keep classes online for the first 9 weeks of the school year, which means no extracurricular activities during that time, which means no football. Ben Bolt is the first high school in Texas to cancel all fall sports. Gary Cunningham is the athletic director of Ben Bolt School District, and we want to welcome you to the show. Coach Cunningham, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And what were the factors? How did y'all come to it?
I was torn from the beginning, torn between giving our kids some sense of normalcy, some sense of let's get back to the way things used to be, and my fear of keeping my kids safe, my coaches safe, and my coaches' families safe. As much as I hated the decision for our kids, especially for our seniors, that they're not going to get a chance to compete their senior year. At the same time, you know, what would happen if something did happen and one of our people got sick and God forbid, passed away from this stuff, you know, I don't think I could live with it. So in that sense, I don't think many people were shocked. Of course, some of the kids were upset, mainly our senior kids. But I think they, deep down inside, they understand. Our community is taking it much better than I thought they would.
Oh, really? Because I am trying to imagine, I mean, this is Texas. It's Friday night without Friday night lights. How is that going down?
I guess, I don't know if we're unique or I don't know. Some places are going crazy over the idea that they might not get to compete. As you would suspect, we had some parents that were upset, and mainly as the parents of seniors. But I don't think there's been the outpouring of anger that some people thought there was gonna be.
Now, I said you're the first high school in Texas to cancel all fall sports. Are you talking to other athletic directors in the state? Are they saying, oh man, I'm so sorry? Or are they saying, you know what, we might be right behind you?
Some are a little bit of both. Some are saying, you know, gosh, our hearts are broken for your kids and for your school. Some, I've had some phone calls from a couple of schools down in the Rio Grande Valley asking, you know, what went into the decision? Why did you make this decision? And how did the community accept this decision? Because I just don't think we're going to be the only school in the state of Texas that ends up not playing football. The Rio Grande Valley is just a hotbed of COVID cases, and it's spreading like wildfire down there. I just don't think it's going to be safe. I don't think they can make it safe. You know, I just don't think we're going to be the only school.
Yeah. Any plans to work with your players to help support them now that they'll be off the field for the fall?
It's really hard because, like I said, there's no kids on campus. All the thing we can do is kind of like this. You know, we visit with them on Zoom. We talk to them periodically on the phone. We check in with them to make sure, you know, they're doing okay. And we're still sending – we send out workouts periodically for them to do at home that they can get out and run and do a little lifting or just something – so that we can stay in touch with them and know that we're still thinking about them and we're still in touch.
Yeah. That is Gary Cunningham, the athletic director of the Fighting Badgers. That's the Ben Bolt School District in South Texas, the first high school in Texas to call off fall sports. Gary Cunningham, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Shifting from sports to the economy, here's an NPR report. A Federal Reserve president says a national lockdown could be the economy's best hope. And then we have a report on housing. Despite the crisis, the U.S. sees a housing boom during the pandemic.
We're going to begin today's program with the chilling news that the United States has now surpassed 5 million confirmed coronavirus cases. This on top of 160,000 deaths and tens of millions of unemployed Americans. And yet, 5 months after the first wave of lockdowns in the U.S., the country's experiencing roughly 50,000 new cases every day. Scientists say we're likely months away from a vaccine, meaning the pandemic will continue to rage unless drastic measures are taken to contain it. Neil Kashkari is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. He has called for a return to mandated lockdowns state by state for up to 6 weeks to save both lives and the economy. And Neil Kashkari joins us now to share his insights. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times with infectious disease expert Michael Osterholm calling for a more restrictive lockdown. You argue that states must mandate sheltering in place now. I'm quoting you now. If we aren't willing to take this action, millions more cases with many more deaths are likely before a vaccine might be available. Now, the public health reasoning here is pretty clear, but this will surely mean more lost jobs, closing of small businesses. What's the economic argument?
Well, the economic argument is what we're doing right now isn't working. Mm-hmm. We did a modest lockdown, and then we let up far too quickly, according to the public health experts. And now our economy is only very slowly recovering. Many people feel scared to go back into restaurants, so restaurants can't return to normal.
Right.
We're not really going to be able to return to a robust economy until we get control of the virus. And at 50,000 cases a day, it's spreading like wildfire throughout the country. And so, unfortunately, yes, a lockdown for 6 weeks would impose short-term pain, but I believe we as a country can afford to support Americans through that short-term lockdown so then we can reopen and have a vigorous economy, have kids returning to school. I want us to get back to a robust economy as quickly as possible. This is much, much faster than allowing the virus to spread uncontrolled.
Now, people listening might be thinking, well, we already tried a lockdown and only leaving the house for essential activities. How is what you're suggesting different than what the country or at least state to state tried this past spring?
Well, two things are different. One is a much more uniform, stringent lockdown. So I've seen estimates that around 39% of workers in the country are, quote unquote, essential, inessential businesses or categories. Yet if you look at Minnesota, 78% of workers were deemed essential by the state. So there was great variation around the country on how stringent the lockdowns were. And then second, we just declared victory far too soon. While cases were declining, the modest lockdown was having a positive effect in the spring. We threw in the towel before the health officials had actually gotten control of the virus. So Dr. Osterholm and I are saying we should do a more stringent uniform lockdown state by state, and then we should hold it until we actually get control of the virus, and then we can return to normal economic activity with more confidence.
And I think what you're suggesting might sound scary to many people who maybe have just gone back to work, who weren't deemed essential, who weren't collecting a paycheck. What would you say to them?
I would say I understand it. To do this lockdown right, we need to provide the assistance to those people who are going to lose their jobs, even temporarily. We as a country have the resources to do it. According to the health experts, this is the single best way to really get our arms around the virus, to squash it, control it, and then allow the economy to open. If you look around the world, many other countries have done this successfully. The United States is an outlier that we have failed to control our virus, and that's why it's spreading like wildfire. If all these other countries can do it, we should be able to do it too. And their economies are recovering more quickly as a result of it.
There's concern often from fiscal conservatives that extending federal unemployment will rack up federal debt. You dispute this. Why?
Well, one of the things that's happened in this recession that's unlike any recession in modern times, our savings rate has taken off. It's really curious. Those of us, like me, who've been able to keep our jobs, we're actually saving more money because we're not going out to restaurants or movies or on vacations. So the personal savings rate has soared from around 8% to 20%. The way it works is that money then gets put in the bank or put into a money market fund, and those resources are available so that when the government runs deficits, it doesn't have to borrow as much from abroad because we're generating the savings domestically. It is much safer for a country to fund its own government deficits from its own people than it is to borrow from abroad. So it turns out we can actually fund the additional unemployment benefits, for example, or additional support to small businesses from our own domestic resources. That is much, much better than having to borrow it from abroad. And so this recession is unique in how we've shut down part of the economy mm-hmm. because it's also generating savings that can support the workers who are most affected. I know it's complicated, but this is a unique moment when the traditional concerns about government deficits and debt to GDP do not apply.
Now, you live in Minnesota, as we mentioned. The state health commissioner there, Jan Malcolm, was quoted in the Minneapolis Star Tribune saying a lockdown would be, quote, an unfortunate step that could become necessary down the road if we don't have enough people step up and make the everyday decisions needed to slow the spread. And I wonder how you would respond to that.
Well, first of all, her leadership, she's doing a lot of work on behalf of the people of Minnesota, and I applaud her for that. So far, we're not seeing it. So far, you know, we're seeing the Sturgis rally, a couple hundred thousand people, motorcycle riders, showing up, apparently not socially distant, in South Dakota. And so I go around, and quite a few businesses are now imposing mask mandates, but I still see some people not wearing masks. And so far, what we are doing is not working in controlling the spread of the virus. We need to do something else. Otherwise, we're going to be at this for the next couple of years, next 18 months, next 2 years, until we have a vaccine that is widely available and widely adopted. And that is a muddle-through strategy that's going to be a very slow economic recovery with a lot of health consequences and economic consequences. Dr. Osterholm and I are arguing we can do much better if we're more aggressive.
That was Neel Kashkari, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So if you look at the state of the economy, you might assume that the housing market is a mess. That, though, is not true. Stacey Vanek-Smith and Cardiff Garcia, who host our podcast, The Indicator, talked to the CEO of Redfin about a surprising housing boom.
Glenn Kelman has been the CEO of Redfin for 15 years. And he says, for all that time, people looking for a home always put this one thing as their top priority.
What about the commute?
The commute to work.
Yes, it's the old real estate mantra, right? Of time immemorial. Location, location, location.
Yeah, and most of the time, those locations were big cities where most of the jobs were concentrated. And as a result, buying a home in these cities had become a kind of blood sport.
The New York real estate market, the San Francisco real estate market, these were insane markets.
Glenn's smaller cities, rural areas, were just a different world. In fact, over the last few years, housing sales had been a little sluggish.
Yeah, that has changed. The National Association of Realtors announced last week that from May to June, just as the COVID-19 crisis was bearing down on businesses and millions of people were losing their jobs, pending home sales rose more than 16%. That's the biggest monthly rise on record.
That is crazy to me because, you know, like one in every five Americans is on unemployment. Like, it's like blowing my mind that home ownership rates might also be going up or that there's a kind of a real estate boom. But it sounds like there is.
Well, it's white-collar professionals who are able to work from home. In some ways, this is a sign that the economy is just officially split in two. You have people who are worried about unemployment benefits running out, and at the same time, you have other people who are able to work from home and thinking about the home all the time, and that's where they want to spend their money.
Glenn says that for the people who are lucky enough to have kept their jobs, a huge number of them are working from home now.
So they're asking the question, well, why do I have to live close to the office? Why can't I live near family? Why can't I live in a place that's more affordable?
And that's changed everything.
The traffic to listings that are in towns with populations of less than 50,000 people is up 87%.
In other words, it's no longer location, location, location. It's more like space, space, space.
Glenn says, for example, that he is seeing a lot of requests for extra bedrooms for parents and grandparents. And he's seeing a lot of requests for extra rooms for offices and home gyms.
I think some of this is just that people are thinking more about their home. And some of it is that they can finally live wherever they want without asking their boss.
And Glenn says he's also seeing a big migration of people out of big cities like New York, L.A., Chicago, and San Francisco to smaller cities like Palm Springs, Tucson, Austin, Grand Rapids, and Nashville.
And those tiny San Francisco and New York apartments that had people in a bidding war, people are leaving those apartments in droves. Stacey Vanek-Smith,
Cardiff Garcia, NPR News.
And finally today, we have this report from Texas Monthly. As if 2020 weren't bad enough, we are now running out of Dr. Pepper. A Good Can is Hard to Find, by Dan Solomon. One of the ways that the emotional roller coaster of 2020 has manifested itself has been in product shortages. Need toilet paper? Sorry, it took months for supply to get back to normal. Want to work out? Through the spring, kettlebells and weight benches were available only on the black market. Basics like flour and yeast took their turns being the hot sold-out product of the moment. And during the Animal Crossing furor of the months of the pandemic, Nintendo Switches were being stockpiled like cigarettes in prison. Bikes and above-ground pools are still scarce as summer begins its extremely slow transition into fall. Even jigsaw puzzles, the hot-ticket home entertainment of the 1930s, disappeared from retailers' shelves. The latest product to get swept into scarcity by these times, though, is one Texans tend to hold very close to our hearts. Dr. Pepper, the beloved soft drink that was invented in Waco in 1885 and for more than a century was bottled in the small central Texas town of Dublin. It was eventually acquired by Keurig in 2018, is now on the watch list for product shortages. The company itself acknowledged the very serious problem in a tweet on Monday. "We know it's getting harder to find Dr. Pepper these days. We're working on it. Hang tight." Note, this applies to all flavors of Dr. Pepper, including our newest permanent addition to the family, Dr. Pepper and Cream Soda. According to USA Today, the shortage can be traced to the aluminum can industry, which wasn't prepared for the huge demand for canned drinks after restaurants closed and people had to satisfy their soda cravings at home. Other soda and beer companies, such as Molson Coors and Coca-Cola, have faced similar issues. Because there are other more pressing concerns in the COVID-19 era, complaining about a shortage of your favorite soft drink feels maybe a wee bit tone deaf. So we won't complain specifically about Dr. Pepper, but we will take just a moment to recognize that it was nicer before, when we lived in a version of America where we never had to worry about things like Dr. Pepper shortages. A potential run on Dr. Pepper is less about the soft drink than it is a bright maroon symbol of what it is like now, living in a country where it's not safe to visit our families, our doctors and nurses are stretched to the breaking point, 160,000 people have died from a disease that the U.S. has proved uniquely incapable of containing, and our economic future looks more uncertain by the moment. We were a different country not that long ago, one where the idea that our supply of a consumer product as ubiquitous as Dr. Pepper could run out felt as absurd as saying, "I don't know, it wouldn't be safe to eat at a restaurant anymore," or "The Big Ten wasn't going to play college football this fall." This too shall pass, of course, and there is reason to be optimistic that at some point in the not-too-distant future, when it would be foolish to guess, we will find ourselves living once more in an America in which supermarket shelves stocked with Dr. Pepper can again be assumed as the birthright of everyone born within its borders. Maybe they'll even get the supply issues worked out sooner than that, and we can leave behind the apocalyptic worry that each can of Dr. Pepper we open may end up being our last. That'd be nice. For now, though, it's just another reminder that we live in uncertain times, and even Dr. Pepper doesn't have the cure. And that is your coronavirus update for this Thursday, August 13th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up next, we'll bring you national news from USA Today. And then at 3 o'clock, our local news. Here's what our volunteers will be reading this day. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Ramsey denies Johnson's claim he wants to raise tax rate. Conaway says trip to Permian made an impact on Trump. Midland still headed to second largest sales tax collection. And from the Odessa American today, 2020 school days underway. ECISD kicks off with emptier buildings and virtual classes. Trustees Hear Broadband Report, and Doctor Talks Precautions. Those are a few of the articles we'll be reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American today at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, the Wall Street Journal, and then tonight at 7, we'll have our Texas Monthly Archives program, in which we will bring you the conclusion of the Roger Staubach article that we began last Thursday. Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3. This week on Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday night movie, Rodgers and Hammerstein's cinematic treasure, The Sound of Music.
As I sound your signals, you will step forward and give your names. You, Fraulein, will listen carefully, learn their signals so you can call them when you want them.
The celebrated play that delighted the world with the performance of a lifetime by the screen's brightest star, Julie Andrews, in the glorious role of Maria.
How do you solve a problem like Maria?
Maria, who entered the strange new world of Captain Von Trapp and captivated his seven children with a magical spell of song.
Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes.
I am 16, going on 17, I know that I'm naive.
Oh, please, Captain, love them all.
I don't care to hear anything further from you
I
about my children.
I am not finished yet,
Oh,
Captain.
Yes, you are.
Are you in love with him?
I don't know. The Baroness said I was. She said that he was in love with me, but I didn't want to believe it.
I love you.
So somewhere in my youth or childhood...
Here is the perfect motion picture that touches every note in the full scale of human emotions.
Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer star in the audio-described The Sound of Music. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 98 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-80s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high around 105. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from the USA Today, Thursday, August 13th, 2020. Starting with the money section, under the money line column, there are a couple of items. The first one, Boston Fed chief hits states reopening. Eric Rosengren, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, criticized the decision by many states to reopen businesses this spring before getting the virus fully under control. And he said those choices have hindered an economic recovery in the U.S. He said states in the South and the West suffered spikes in infection rates, and economies in those states are now lagging. Rosengren's comments are some of the most specific yet by a Federal Reserve official tying the health of the economy to the nation's ability to control the virus. Second item, the week's jobless claims likely to remain high. The number of Americans filing new unemployment claims may continue to seesaw, creeping up and then falling slightly, but the level will likely remain stubbornly high as economic uncertainty lingers amid surges in coronavirus cases. About 1.25 million Americans filed initial applications for unemployment insurance last week, economists estimate. That slight increase over the previous week comes as the extra $600 federal weekly benefit ended July 31st. And the last item in that column, Steinmart files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Off-price retailer Steinmart is the latest in a list of businesses to file for bankruptcy protection amid the coronavirus pandemic. The retailer said Wednesday it plans to close a significant portion, if not all, of its brick-and-mortar stores and has launched a store closing and liquidation process, according to a news release. The company says its 281 stores in 30 states will continue to operate during Chapter